This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
This is Rock Cash, your host this week on A People Speak Radio. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 805-399-1000, access code 769608, pound, when prompted. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to the station 2, click on the icon, and listen in. You can also participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free, USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. This evening, our guest is Yusuf Munayyar. Yusuf is a Palestinian-American writer and political analyst based in Washington, D.C. He is currently the executive director of the Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development. Yusuf was also a policy analyst with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. Yusuf is here to speak about the ferocious war crimes committed by Ariel Sharon in his efforts to derail peace and cause genocides of thousands of Palestinians, Sabra and Shatila, the village of Kibya. Let's not forget the other path of destruction Sharon took when he walked into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, causing the Second Intifada. Yusuf, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Fill us in more on Ariel Sharon. Israelis are calling him a hero, but of course, he is more of a menace to society more than anything else.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing Ariel Sharon really excelled at in his tenure, both as a military commander and as a leader in the Israeli political establishment, was first at, you know, committing heinous war crimes against Arabs and in specific against Palestinians, and also in committing perhaps his greatest massacre, which was the massacre of a peace process through the steadfast support for the Israeli settlement enterprise, which has essentially turned the West Bank into Swiss cheese. The sort of long-term goal that Ariel Sharon and many other Israelis during the 1960s and 1970s had was to place Israeli colonies, or settlements as the Israelis call them, throughout the West Bank in such a way so as to make an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank impossible. And, you know, his greatest legacy, if not perhaps the legacy of the bloody war crimes that he committed throughout the years that he had those opportunities, is the legacy that Israel deals with today, and that is the fact that it has close to 750,000 settlers in the West Bank, and is continuing a military occupation now there for the fifth decade, and unable to find a way out precisely because it is so beholden and subservient to the settlement interests.
Can you explain to us about the village of Gibeah and also Sabra and Shatila and the crimes that were committed there?
Sure, absolutely. One thing you have to remember about Ariel Sharon is that he has been involved in pretty much every war and major event in Israeli history. I tell people he's sort of like the evil Israeli twin of Forrest Gump, having played a role in every event in history, but really in a bad way. And it starts in 1948 when he was involved in war then, and of course the depopulation of Palestine in a smaller capacity. But in the village of Kibia in 1953, he was in charge of leading something called Unit 101, which was an Israeli commando unit that was established to essentially create a really significant destruction and impose very high costs on Palestinian targets to really bloody the Palestinians into submission and to cause Palestinians to think very carefully before ever carrying out acts of resistance against Israelis. And in the village of Kibia in 1953, he led that commando unit in what was a raid on a village, a civilian village, and demolished countless Palestinian homes, while many civilians remained inside those homes. And when the smoke cleared, we came to know that about 70 Palestinian civilians were killed, most of whom were women and children. Through the horrific destruction carried out by Ariel Sharon and under his leadership, his war crimes, of course, only began at those early years and continued. In 1970, when he was in charge of Israel's Southern Command, he led several efforts in Gaza with the Israelis, hoped for was to subdue Palestinian resistance. But Sharon decided to do so by demolishing thousands of homes in Palestinian refugee camps, essentially imposing massive collective punishment on a civilian population, which, of course, is illegal under international law. And after that, he left the military and then became responsible for different massacres in the political establishment. And in 1982, most infamously, he was the Israeli defense minister when Israel was invading southern Lebanon, occupying western Beirut, and ultimately had control over the perimeter of the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila as Palestinians were being massacred inside. And in fact, an Israeli commission that was appointed by the Israeli government to investigate what happened in Sabra and Shatila, found that Ariel Sharon bore personal responsibility for the massacres and recommended that he never hold a ministerial position ever again.
Wow. You know, I've heard so many stories, but of course I was there in 67, and I remember Israelis shooting at our feet, so it's not like they cared about who they shot at, just as long as they got their point across. Yusuf?
Yes, sir.
Can you also fill us in more about Sabra and Shatila? What was it that he exactly did to commit the crimes? Was it that he allowed the Lebanese to come in and kill the Palestinians in the camps?
You have to remember that Ariel Sharon was responsible at the time as Minister of Defense over the Israeli campaign in Lebanon. But at the same time, he also had a sort of grand scheme for the larger Middle East. And one of the really disastrous ideas that he had was that he could essentially play kingmaker in Lebanon, affect the outcome of the civil war in such a way that they could put Lebanese factions that were sympathetic to the Israelis in charge of Lebanon, get the Palestinians out of Lebanon, and have them ultimately put into Jordan. And Jordan would, eventually become a Palestinian state, and Israel would keep the entirety of historic Palestine and be able to, continue its colonization project in the West Bank. And of course, what we learned from the Israeli experiment in Lebanon is that, of course, the Israelis were not able to do that, and in the process of attempting to do that, left a very bloody path. particularly in sub-branch Shatila. But you have to remember that the Israelis were occupying southern Lebanon for many years after the events in sub-branch Shatila, and committed a number of violations of international law throughout that time in occupation there. And the, you know, the residue of Israeli occupation in Lebanon is still present and felt to this day. And so Ariel Sharon's legacy from 1982 and the actions that he took then are still being felt by many throughout the region.
Yeah, well, a lot of people's lives have been completely distorted and displaced. And, you know, it's unfortunate that there are war crimes, but why are they still getting away with it? And why are they still escaping justice?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a question that all, you know, responsible peace-seeking people should be asking. And look, there are mechanisms in the international system to deal with war crimes. We've seen a number of war crimes tribunals and commissions and courts deal with war criminals from Rwanda, from the former Yugoslavia, and a host of other places as well. Unfortunately, the Israelis have been able to exercise total impunity when it comes to accountability for war crimes. And one of the biggest reasons for that is because when push comes to shove in international arenas, more often than not, the United States, which exercises a veto in the United Nations Security Council, has been willing to consistently support Israel, right or wrong, with its veto and stymie any sort of international movement against Israel for these violations. And it's interesting, the Israelis always claim that there is a bias at the United Nations against Israel. But in reality, the United Nations has sanctions against a host of other nations that are committing violations of international law or international agreements. And despite the fact that the Israelis are in constant violation of international law and international agreements, there are no sanctions, United Nations sanctions, targeting Israel. If anything, the United Nations and the international community has been far too lenient towards Israel for its violations of international law. In large part, that's because the United States has played the role as the protector.
Yeah, well, wasn't Israel just recently convicted of the war crimes for Sabra and Shatila? They were Israel, and there was another general that was directly involved that was also convicted of the war crimes by the Hague. But once again, impunity never seems to reach those who are committing the crimes.
There's a culture of impunity in Israel when it comes in particular to violations of international law and human rights of Palestinians. And the reason that that distinction is important is because the Israeli legal and judicial system is actually quite just when it comes to crimes committed by Israelis against other Jews. So the mechanisms are there for justice, except the bias is so prevalent against Palestinians in those systems that Israelis that commit crimes against Arabs or Palestinians are never held to account. You know, if Ariel Sharon was held to account for the crimes that he perpetuated in Tibya in 1953, if he was in fact removed from public life in 1953, he never would have been able to commit the crimes that we witnessed in 1970. He never would have been in a position of power to preside over the crimes in Sabra and Shatila. And he never would have been able to become prime minister and preside over the single largest period of Israeli settlement population expansion since the 1960s and 1970s. This culture of impunity is a big part of the problem. Unfortunately, while Israel has the capacity to do something about it, the institutionalized bias against Palestinians has continued to allow Israeli perpetrators of war crimes to get away with it.
Well, not only Israeli perpetrators of war crimes, but also regular crimes that are being committed. I believe there was countless Palestinians that were killed at the hands of Jews, and not a single Jew has ever paid for his crimes in Israel.
That's not exactly true. There is a Israeli system in the West Bank, which is a military system. And while it is true that the vast majority of cases go either unresponded to or are dismissed, particularly when it comes to Israeli settler violence against Palestinian civilians. There are few cases in which perpetrators have been tried and brought to justice, but even in those cases, the sentences which they do receive are far less in comparison to sentences that they would have received had their victims been Israeli Jews instead of Palestinians. And so the system is decidedly against Palestinians. There is very little access to justice for Palestinians, particularly Palestinian victims at the hands of Israeli perpetrators. And this ultimately is the product of occupation. This is a military occupation which has gone on now in the West Bank for decades. And this unequal system of laws is only going to produce these types of unequal outcomes. And so ultimately for this to change, there must be a change in the broader situation and an end to Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory.
I have a question from a listener from Ontario, Chirper. He wants to know what you think about the idea of charging Sharon through the IC posthumously.
To be honest with you, I'm really not sure if that's possible. I'm not familiar enough with those mechanisms to know if that's really something that that can be done. I think it is important that the victims of Sabra and Shatila do get justice in some way. And that, the Israeli state ultimately be held accountable, because at the end of the day, it was the Israeli state that, enabled and helped produce the outcome there, as well as the individuals who were involved. So I think, if there are avenues for justice that can be explored, they should. But about that specific method, I'm really not in a position to say.
That's great. We're going to take a quick break. This is Rakesh. We'll be right back with the BBS Radio Network and the People Speak and our guest, Yusuf Munir. We'll be right back.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak on the BBS Radio Network. This is Rock Cash with my guest, Yusuf Munyar. Yusuf, welcome back.
Thanks.
Let's go back to where we left off as far as the IC, because of our situation earlier. What can we as Americans do to help enlighten the people that are out there? Because I know we don't get the time of day on mainstream media. So what's the best way to reach out to people that don't really understand what's going on there?
Well, I think there's a number of different things that you could do. I think perhaps the most important is continue to educate people through your immediate networks. And not to underestimate the effects of that, because sometimes it's the people that you could reach on a personal level who could become, you know, the most effective in carrying the message forward. So there's that. I think there's also, of course, engagement in the various civic systems wherever it is that your listeners are hearing this, in an attempt to change the way that policymakers deal with this issue, and engaging them and educating them about the plight of the Palestinians and the need for justice for Palestinians. And, of course, there is another sort of more even personal way to get involved, and that's through really the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Which can be something as simple as knowing which products are in some ways supportive of Israeli occupation and Israeli policies that further human rights violations against Palestinians and so on, and making the conscious choice not to purchase those products and making an effort not to invest in companies that produce those products or are involved in some way in the occupation. And these kind of activities, these kind of movements, are starting to have an increased effect on the Israeli economy. And ultimately, it's really not until the Israeli state begins to realize that there is a hefty price to pay for perpetual occupation and for continued violations of Palestinian human rights, then they're not going to change their behavior. So this is a very simple and straightforward way for anybody, wherever they are, to make a conscious effort in affecting the situation. And no any one individual's effect is too small. These kind of civil society efforts rely on the cumulative effect of many participants. And so I think it's a great way to educate and also be involved for real change.
Yeah, I noticed that the Jewish Voice of Peace has been hosting boycotts on Israeli products, and they've also got the Scholastic Association to also boycott the schools in Israel. There seems to be a little bit of change in the demeanor of the Israelis, but it's not enough of a change to where they're still pushing for more settlements, and they're still stealing more land. Once again, how can more people get involved? Is it through the through your organization, the Jerusalem Fund, or is it through other organizations that are out there? I'm sure there's numerous organizations that are on the same path.
Well, I would certainly encourage your listeners to check out our website and get to know the work that we do. You can find us at www.thejerusalemfund.org and find out plenty more about our work, both in terms of the humanitarian efforts that we make in supporting Palestinians on the ground, but also our efforts to educate people about the situation in Palestine. And learn a great deal about the situation there as well. While it is still a very nascent movement, I wouldn't sell the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement short. Certainly, the amount of pressure that is needed to change Israeli behavior is far greater than what's been achieved so far. But again, this is a broad effort that takes time to grow, and the signs of growth are significant and promising. And if more people get involved with this effort and more people begin to shun Israeli products, and more companies that are investing in settlements or based in settlements continue to see that their profits decline and that their investment numbers go down, those are going to add up and eventually send a very strong message to Israeli decision makers, a message that unfortunately the leaders here in the United States have not been able to send, and that is that their occupation simply cannot continue to go on.
What do you think about a two-state solution or a one-state solution? What is your preference?
I don't think that it's really a question of one state or two. I think that any solution that is going to last and is going to be credible is a solution that realizes human rights for Palestinians and Israelis. But if Palestinian human rights are treated as part of the negotiations process, if Palestinian human rights are, negotiable, that's not going to work. There are a few basic principles to any just and lasting solution. And those are an end to the Israeli occupation and self-determination for Palestinians, a right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with international law, and the equal treatment of Palestinians living inside of Israel. And so, it's really not a question of where and how you draw the line, but about whether or not Palestinian human rights are being fully recognized by whatever agreement we're talking about. And I think that if they are, then you'll have an agreement that lasts. But if they're not, no such agreement is even worth discussing.
Well, yes, of course. There's been a misappropriation of the statutes that were passed down through the Oslo Accords, and other peace processes, and they keep trying to put the finger on the Palestinians, saying that the Palestinians won't take the offer, but they don't tell the people that they're giving Palestinians offers with conditions that really are absolutely ferocious and meaningless, because nobody would accept those agreements by any stretch of anybody's imagination. Because basically it's taking away a lot more land from the Palestinians, and it's not going by the actual agreements that were taken in the Oslo Accord. So can you please fill us in more on that?
Sure. Look, the Palestinians should not accept any agreement that offers them anything less than 100% of what they are entitled to as far as international law is concerned, as far as their human rights are concerned. Palestinian human rights are non-negotiable. Period. And any, framework agreement or interim agreement that fails to take that into account is going to go nowhere. And it really isn't, worth the time and effort of the major players and the leadership of being involved in, because it's not going to solve the issue. And you're right to say that the previous agreements and discussions, whether it was the Oslo Accord or George Bush's roadmap or President Obama's most recent efforts, all of them have more or less ignored very significant numbers of Palestinians and stakeholders among the Palestinian population and their legitimate grievances. And more often than not, this is, Palestinian refugees. One thing people don't realize is that in the events of 1948 and the depopulation of Palestine, that didn't affect 5% of the Palestinian population or 10% or 20% of the Palestinian population. That affected 67% of the Palestinian population directly in that it made them refugees. And so the refugee issue and the right of return is the central issue for Palestinians when it comes to any resolution with Israel. And so any effort at a peace agreement that ignores the right of return or doesn't deal with it directly and fairly is bound to fail. And obviously the Israelis, are opposed to that. And, of course, the Americans have supported the Israeli position on that. And that's, the main reason why we are at a situation today where after decades of negotiating, we are further and further away from anything that looks like a solution than ever before.
Wow. With that being said, we do take in calls from our listeners. So I've got Fred from Wisconsin. Go ahead, Fred. Fred, are you there?
Hearing what you have to say. And my question is, I've been studying terrorism over the last decade or so, and I've come across incidents such as, the USS Liberty, the letters along with the anthrax attacks sent to U.S. politicians included words saying, death to Israel, Allah Akbar, this type of thing. 9/11 was a very interesting event, and even, the use of white phosphorus on innocent civilians, I think, in Palestine and Iraq. I was wondering if you thought, in your research, what you knew about these events, and if you thought that Israel maybe uses tactics or strategies of false flag terrorism to further their own goals.
Your call has certainly brought up a number of different things. Not all of them I really have expertise in to kind of delve into. But terrorism is often a phrase that is used to characterize or delegitimize the resistance of weaker parties, often that are struggling for self-determination against states and the sort of the legalistic mechanisms that are around the discourse on terrorism have had an effect of politically repressing these types of movements. But if we look at sort of the essence of terrorism and you know, many of the sort of the common definitions of terrorism include such elements as the use of force against the civilian population for the objective of advancing political goals. States and non-state actors are perfectly capable of perpetuating terrorism under such a definition. And the Israelis, of course, have perpetrated many acts against the Palestinian civilian population with the effort of, achieving political objectives and in effect, terrorizing them. I think if you look at the, you know, the collective punishment on the Gaza Strip, there is no doubt that the collective punishment of the Gaza Strip through Israeli policies such as the siege and the blockade are aimed at coercing a civilian population and punishing them, through this mass collective punishment for a political objective. It's unpopular in the mainstream discourse to talk about states as perpetrators of terrorism, but if we're being honest with ourselves about the meaning of these terms and what's actually happening on the ground, it's very clear to see that states are just as capable of committing these crimes as non-state actors as well.
Great.
Yeah, thank you. I guess my fear is that a state like Israel or the Mossad or the CIA could in fact employ extremists in foreign countries to, you know, kind of do acts of terrorism to further their own goal and kind of separate themselves from it, say, if they wanted to go into war with Syria, for example. I think Saudi Arabia, Israel, and some neocons in America want to actually go to war in Syria and Iran. And my question is, if you thought that they would employ the tactics of false flag terrorism, hire some extremists, start the civil war in Syria, and then go in on a humanitarian mission or something, if that would be possible.
Yeah, I mean, I really can't speculate as to, Israeli strategy vis-a-vis Syria and covert operations and so on. But you know, we do know that there have been episodes in history where the Israelis have used or attempted to use false flag operations in their relationship with other Arab states, and one of the perhaps most infamous of these cases is the Levant affair, which took place in 1954, in which Israelis undertook this covert operation in Egypt, which was ultimately part of a false flag effort to provoke a confrontation there. And it became known as sort of the Levant affair after the Israeli defense minister at the time, who of course came under a great deal of criticism and condemnation, received a lot of condemnation for this strategy and this operation. These kind of tactics are tactics that are employed around the world and by a number of states. Israel has obviously been capable of doing it in the past, and it's not, out of the realm of reasonable imagination to believe that they could employ such tactics again or haven't already done so as well.
All right.
Thank you, man. Keep up the good fight. I appreciate all the work. We need a more peaceful society, and I think the truth helps us get there, and I've enjoyed listening. So thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you, Fred. Yusuf, I've got a listener in Australia that wants to know why Israel won't let inspectors into Dimona to check the nukes? And why is it that the world tells Iran that the weapons inspectors need to go in? What makes Israel so special that nobody can go in there? It's like they have their own set of rules, and they only play by their rules.
Well, you know, many people will look at the you know, the fact that there's this international regime now aimed at limiting the Iranian nuclear program. And look, of course, at the you know, Israeli nuclear program and say, well, look at that double standard. And there is, of course, a double standard. What complicates things in the Iranian issue is, of course, Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and Israel is not. And this, you know, this part of, you know, international legal and diplomatic reality has made things far more difficult for the Iranians, because it has enabled the building of this regime against the Iranian nuclear program. But you're right, the Israelis have been able to largely avoid criticism of their nuclear weapons program. We know, of course, that they do have the largest per capita nuclear arsenal in the world. They certainly have the largest nuclear arsenal in the immediate region. They could, easily, use those weapons in such a way to essentially destroy every capital in the Arab and Muslim world in the matter of minutes. And they've also been known to proliferate nuclear technology, specifically in the case of apartheid South Africa. And so there's no doubt that, you know, when it comes to the nuclear question, Israel is not only a user and abuser of nuclear technology, but has done so really without, you know, any accountability. And they've continued this policy that they, you know, that they call a policy of sort of ambiguity, where they neither officially confirm or deny the existence of nuclear weapons in Israel, but we know, of course, because, you know, most famously, Mordechai Vanunu came forward with information that he published in the Sunday Times about what was going on in Dimona. He was, of course, an employee there, a conscientious objector, and now a political prisoner, of course, for revealing those secrets about Israel's nuclear program. But the sad thing is, you know, the United States has in many ways adopted this Israeli policy of ambiguity towards Israel's nuclear weapons. And, you know, American presidents have also, you know, basically stayed away from stating clearly whether Israel has or doesn't have nuclear weapons. And while the Israelis, you know, can say whatever they want about their own, you know, nuclear stockpiles, it's not clear to me why the Americans feel like they have to cover for the Israelis as well by going along with this strategy. And, you know, when President Obama was first elected, he was asked very directly at the time by, you know, the late Helen Thomas, in his first press conference, she said, you know, Mr. President, are you aware of any country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons? And President Obama dodged the question, refused to answer the question directly, even though he knows, and the United States intelligence apparatus, of course, knows that Israel is the only state in the region that actually has nuclear weapons. And so, you know, this is a problem that I think really, you know, should be called out, and that is that the United States has gone along with this Israeli policy of ambiguity and should be doing the opposite and really calling Israel out for its nuclear program and demanding that it obviously should open up its facilities to international inspectors and come clean about the entire program.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Chirper from Canada wants to know what you think about the visit to Israel by the Canadian Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Prime Minister Harper has become, you know, one of the strongest advocates for Israel on the international scene. He has rivaled, if not overtaken, the positions of many American politicians, which have long since declared their overt bias towards Israel in the Middle East. And he's now in the Middle East and visiting there, it's unclear really what is behind Prime Minister Harper's clear alignment with the Israeli government, and we've even seen a softening in the Canadian position on some of the most fundamental issues that have been persistent from one Canadian administration to the other when it comes to the Israelis, including on the question of settlement and international law. Certainly Canadian politics, particularly at the premiership level, has taken a turn for the worse when it comes to its policies towards Israel and the Palestinians, it's an unfortunate thing to see. But Prime Minister Harper has in fact gone in that direction, and is one of the most stalwart allies of the Israeli Prime Minister and the Israeli government in the world today.
Wow. Let's move on. Sylvia in Ohio wants to know why the U.S. government supports Israel. If Israel is an apartheid state, doesn't that make the United States just as guilty as Israel in its human rights violations?
Well, there's a couple of different sort of competing theories as to why the United States supports Israel. One idea is that, United States has a broad regional interests in the Middle East that include, of course, the security of certain natural resources like oil and gas and so on, which it needs for its economy. And having an ally in Israel provides for it a foothold in the region, and so this is, of course, very useful for U.S. interests. The other idea is that pro-Israel interest groups exercise a oversized amount of leverage over U.S. policy towards Israel in the Middle East, and are able to push U.S. policy in a direction which goes against American interests and any sort of genuine resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I think there's a good amount of truth to both of these ideas. While the people in the United States are, broadly supportive of Israel, they are unlikely to be supportive of many Israeli policies, including the denial of self-determination to millions of people, which goes directly against core U.S. values, core American values. And so I think pro-Israel interest groups have a lot to do with it, and also U.S. Interests in the region have a lot to do with it as well. But in many occasions in American history, U.S. support for Israel has become, something of a headache for American presidents and has complicated policymaking and the achievement of policy objectives in the region, sometimes more than it's made it easier. And so there are many times when I'm sure presidents have asked, why is it that we support Israel again? But it is, of course, a domestic political issue, and it is, of course, a geostrategic issue, less so, today than it was in the Cold War era, but still to some extent today.
Wow. Last question for you. Francis in Indiana wants to know what you feel about AIPAC, and does AIPAC have a evil controlling influence on the American government and foreign policy?
I don't think AIPAC has an evil controlling influence on American policy. I do think they do have an influence. I do think they are very effective at what they do. I do think that they have intimidated policymakers and elected officials, and that intimidation has led policymakers, members of Congress, and so on, to think very seriously about the consequences of taking any stances that are critical of Israel. And has worked to sort of enforce a pro-Israel line inside the Beltway here in Washington. And I think that, AIPAC is a pro-Israel lobby, and they do what they do very well. It is part and parcel of the American system that you can lobby policymakers and members of Congress. But when it comes to questions of foreign policy, particularly, such serious questions as the Israeli-Palestinian question, when you have interest groups that are influential to this extent, moving or helping to move U.S. policy in a direction that is contrary to stated objectives of U.S. policy, it becomes very problematic and really handcuffs the United States and makes it impossible for them to really achieve anything at all when it comes to the stated objectives of the United States, which is, of course, an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. I think AIPAC's effect is very problematic. I would never characterize it, though, in the terms that that you're calling it.
Do you think the Israelis, with the media and the AIPAC and everything else, do they have the ways of character assassination of politicians? And do you think that maybe blackmailing of the politicians is possible by AIPAC in order to get them to go with whatever they want them to do? So it seems like they've got a very, very strong hold, and it can't be just the motivation of the dollars into the political arena, but there must be something there that is substantial that's really scaring these politicians to not go against Israel.
Right, and it's not only campaign donations. Sometimes it comes in the form of primary challenges and other avenues as well. It's very clear what these interest groups have been able to accomplish over time, and essentially, if you are a member of Congress that is, unwilling to vote in a certain way or on a certain piece of legislation in support of Israel, it wouldn't be surprising to find out that the pro-Israel interest groups are suddenly supporting your opponent in the next upcoming election. This is what lobbies do. They lobby for their interests. We see this with a lot of lobbies, of course, on a variety of different issues, whether it's the gun lobby, whether it's the tobacco lobby, whether it's, any other lobby. Lobbies are going to do what it is that they're made to do. The problem with the lobbies that we're talking about here, pro-Israel lobbies, is that with the other examples that I cited, like the gun lobby, for example, there are often counterbalancing lobbies as well. So while you have a group like the NRA, for example, you have very vocal an active movement for greater restriction on guns and for laws restricting the proliferation of guns in the United States. When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, there is a huge disparity in power and resources between the lobbies on either side of these issues. And so the influence of the pro-Israel side is exponentially more impactful on this issue than another lobby on a contentious issue, which may be very much opposed by a counterbalancing lobby.
True, true. But, you know, the Israelis still have the media and, once again, the political onslaught. Anyways, we need to wrap it up, Yusuf. I want to thank you very much for making the show, and we'd like to have you on again at another time when something comes up again with Palestine and the Israeli situation, if that would be possible. And once again, thank you for coming. This is Rock Cash, your host on The People Speak on the BBS Radio Network. Special thanks to our awesome sound engineer, Don Newsom. Make sure you join us next week. Lynn Stewart, lawyer of the ignored and oppressed, freed at last. See you next week. Have a good evening.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.